I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZE Foundation, which leads public competitions to drive innovation. Peter launched the XPRIZE Foundation in 1994, and the first prize of $10 million was awarded in 2004 to the creators of the first piloted spacecraft called Spaceship One. The XPRIZE focuses on four areas: exploration, life sciences, energy, and global development. Peter's also the co-founder of Singularity University, which helps professionals in all fields better understand cutting-edge technologies. Peter is the author of the books Abundance and Bold, and he's a graduate of MIT and Harvard Medical School. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to strip away all the technology and innovation for a moment and talk about Great Neck, New York.
Okay. Yes, I went to junior high school and high school there. And it was great. It was a great school, a lot of amazingly smart people. And it's really where I started becoming conscious as a scientist, entrepreneur, someone passionate about space and computers and all these techie things.
Your father was an OBGYN.
Yeah.
Did your mother work?
Yeah, my mom ran his office. She could well have been a physician as well, but she basically ran his office. And I grew up in a medical family, a family where my parents were both born in the small island of Lesbos in Greece. Came over, my mom when she was 10, my dad after medical school. And they both had very humble beginnings. I heard stories about, you know, not having enough food to eat during the day and all of that. And I used to think that the journey that they took from their village and island in Greece to, you know, New York physician was like this epic journey that would be the equivalent of me going to Mars.
Speaking of Mars, you had this deep fascination with space in Great Neck, New York.
Yeah.
What was the germ for this space interest?
Well, I was born in the 60s. The germ was the Apollo program and Star Trek. Apollo was like, you know, you become conscious during a decade where this epic, impossible, crazy journey is taking place, and it becomes the norm. You know, you assume, oh, yeah, of course, humanity does amazing things like this. It sort of calls its shot and goes to the moon and over and over and over again. And then all of a sudden, it's not anymore. And that disconnect also fueled me.
Were you one of those tough kids?
No, I was not at all. I was probably the kid picked on more than anything else. I was a bit of a geek. I was tough only in my perseverance, I think.
Now, did you want to break out of Long Island, New York, or were you kind of a content adolescent wanting to perhaps have a career in medicine?
I was expected to become a doctor. It was sort of the family business. But in my deepest heart of hearts, I wanted to be an astronaut.
While you were in medical school, you founded the Space Generation Foundation, the International Space University. You headed a company called International Microspace. So it was very much top of mind while, by the way, you're a student at Harvard Medical School.
Yeah. It was my passion was space. My day job was being a student. And the funny thing is, you know, my fourth year in medical school, I had two companies I was running. And I would go and work the night shift at Mass General Hospital from 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. And then I would go home and sleep for 6 hours, then go to the office from noon until 10 p.m. and would repeat, you know, over and over again. And it was sort of like I was committed to getting my degree. And when I finally did get it, barely, I, you know, photocopied and sent a copy to my parents and then went off to go and work at my companies.
Incidentally, my family, they're Harvard Med professors. They probably wouldn't be happy knowing that students was working another day job.
Yeah, my dean back then, Dean Tostison, who's passed away since, I had a very cathartic moment with him where he called me in and basically said, listen, all of your interns and residents are sort of telling me you're on the phone all the time, you're not paying attention, you're not doing your full abilities. What's going on here? And I fessed up, you know, almost in tears because he was, you know, this was like the meeting where I might get kicked out of medical school. And I said, listen, my dream and passion is space. I want to do this. And he goes, do you want to graduate? I said, dearly. And he said, well, I'll make you a deal. If you promise you don't practice medicine and you pass part two of your boards, I'll let you graduate. He kept his promise, I kept mine.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Pierre Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZE, a foundation that drives innovation through competition with the hopes of improving the human experience. You got your medical degree and instead pursued this space route, yet you had challenges on the venture capital front on raising capital for your companies. One was, as I mentioned before, International Microspace, which was bringing loads into orbit, basically. Can you just describe that briefly?
Briefly, I had just started the International Space University. It was a huge success.
And what was that?
Well, International Space University was a graduate-level program for studying all aspects of space, space business, medicine, engineering, life sciences, architecture, all those things. And it's still going today as one of the leading institutions for the graduate study of space. It's based in Strasbourg, France. It started out of MIT. And on the heels of that, it's like, what can I do next? And I said, you know, the launch vehicle world, you know, getting stuff into space is really expensive, really hard, and there's a marketplace there. So built a company with an amazing group, and we took a shot at building low-cost launch vehicles, what people know, you know, SpaceX and companies like that to be doing now. And we built it, we won a large contract, but we were never able to capitalize the company fully and never actually launched the vehicles and eventually sold it to a company, CTA, into Orbital Sciences, and never flew. I was disappointed by that.
Rather than chase money, you then decided that you would make others chase money by building this organization, the XPRIZE, where you're incentivizing people to innovate, being rewarded by, you know, millions of dollars. What was the germ for the gaming aspect of XPRIZE?
Having just come off of this failed launch vehicle, and again, fueled by this childhood passion of wanting to go into space, at the same time, I was trying to finish up my pilot's license. And a dear friend of mine, Greg Marinac, gave me a copy of Charles Lindbergh's biography, The Spirit of St. Louis. And he said, read this. This will be your motivation to finish your pilot's license. It's an amazing epic journey of this pilot. And I had no idea that in 1927, Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic to win a $25,000 prize. The story is amazing. This Frenchman, Raymond Orteig, born under the Pyrenees Mountains in the late 1800s, comes to New York, works his way up from a busboy eventually to the owner of the Hotel Lafayette. During World War I, the airplane had made its debut in the world. And at this hotel, he catered to pilots from this World War I. I guess they called themselves aviators or aeronauts back then. He said, I wonder if aviation could connect my new home of New York, my old home of France. And so in 1919, he offers up a $25,000 prize for the first person to fly between New York and Paris, or Paris and New York. And that $25,000, as I'm reading in Lindbergh's autobiography, inspires nine different teams who spent $400,000 to win this $25,000 prize. And I said, and there was just a moment in time where I wrote down in the margins space prize. And I said, maybe this is how I could encourage the development of private launch vehicles that would carry me and my friends into space. And then not knowing who was going to fund it, who was my Orteig, who was my Pulitzer, my Nobel, so to speak, I wrote the word X as a placeholder, and that became the XPRIZE.
You announced the prize before you had the capital, and the prize, the first prize, was for this piloted spacecraft. The funder, whom you eventually found, is a female Iranian engineer,
yeah.
Anousheh Ansari.
Yeah.
How did you come into contact with her?
So you're correct. In May of 1996, May 18th to be exact, we had raised about $500,000 of capital from St. Louis. And the fundraising was slow, and we took a gamble. And the gamble was we're going to announce the $10 million prize anyway, with the notion that if we got enough publicity, we'd find the funder. I had two board members resign when we decided to do that. We announced the prize under the arch in St. Louis, and I started on this journey to go and find backers. And I pitched Richard Branson twice. I pitched Fred Smith, the CEO of FedEx. You know, lots of CEOs, 150 CEOs, philanthropists, and all of them said, you know, why isn't NASA doing this? Can anyone really build a privately funded spaceship, and can they do it safely? Will someone die? I was told no over and over and over again, 150 times. And ultimately, one day I was reading a copy, I think it was Fortune magazine, and it had a listing of the wealthiest 40 women under 40. And Anusha had just sold her company to Telecom Technologies for $1.3 billion. And she was listed. In her bio, it said her dream was to fly on a suborbital flight into space. And I was just taken aback, and I committed to tracking her down, which I did. She was vacationing in Hawaii, and I was her first meeting when she got back, and they agreed to fund the prize.
What was your sense of self like during this time? You know, you had trouble raising capital from your for-profit venture. You're receiving no's relentlessly. Are you like, you know what? In my private moments, like looking at the mirror, what was that conversation like?
It was hard, no question about it. You know, I had had a number of, you know, early successes.
But your raising capital was not your forte.
Well, I would say it probably is my forte more than ever now. But back then, I was working hard. I was raising capital for really hard stuff. But what I realized was this was the most important stuff in my life. And I would not want to do anything else. I always have viewed that space and doing these big, bold things was my guiding star. And when I would get depressed and I would sort of get, when things would get fuzzy and I'd finally get some sleep and re-energize, that guiding star was always there and it always drove me.
Anush was a turning point for you in the capital coming in. What were other like fulcrum moments for you in addition?
There have been many of those over life. Meeting Anusha was definitely a turning point. Of course, when Burt Rutan, backed by Paul Allen, gave notice that they were going to compete was important because, frankly, having a prize that no one competed for. Right? We had 26 teams around the world who spent on the order of $100 million, but having someone like Burt, a legend in the aviation business, decide that he was going to go into space and then pulled it off, that was extraordinary.
And Paul Allen, founder of Microsoft.
Yeah, when Paul Allen, who had made his wealth in Microsoft, backing Burt, and spending $26 million to win the $10 million prize really, really credentialed the concept and allowed us on the heels of that to really give birth to the X Prize as a platform for doing extraordinary things.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Peter Diamandis, founder of the X Prize Foundation. We'll hear more from Peter coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Peter Diamandis, the founder of the X Prize, a foundation that drives innovation through competition with the hopes of improving the human experience. These prizes are focused on bold yet achievable projects ranging from space exploration to the human genome. Peter is author with Stephen Kotler of Abundance, Future is Better Than You Think, about technology innovation driving better standards of living for the world's growing population, and Bold, the importance of technology disruption. I want to talk about the history of prizes
for
a moment. What are some prizes that we might not know about, you know, just historically that have fueled other innovations in time?
Sure. So the very first prize ever in recorded history that I studied is the Longitude Prize. In the year 1714, the British Admiralty put up a fortune for the first person to be able to tell the longitude. You could tell latitude by simply where the sun was rising on the horizon. But to tell longitude was very difficult. And because the early navigators could not tell longitude accurately, the Navy was losing thousands and thousands of their men on the rocks as they'd come back to port. And they thought an astronomer was going to figure it out. So the longitude board, the judging body, was filled with astronomers. And it turned out to be John Harrison, a watchmaker, a tinkerer, who came up with a very accurate clock on the highly humid, rocking seas that ultimately won the prize, much to the chagrin of the astronomers. There was in the 1840s when Napoleon was marching on Russia and losing his men from malnutrition because the supply line was so long, he offered up a prize for food preservation. And it was won by Nicholas Appert, who came up with canning food. Mm-hmm. And he was a French candy maker. And a lot of early aviation prizes put up by the media, actually. The newspapers put up a lot of these, the Daily Mail and such, because they wanted to create good news stories and heroes.
And incidentally, Netflix, bringing it back to modern times in 2009, had a $1 million prize to find the best algorithm to help them predict what people's favorite movies would be.
Yeah.
Do you think that was on the heels of the XPRIZE
incident? Oh, yeah. I know the guys who ran it. And they do say, and there's been a multitude of prizes. I think the Ansari X Prize reinvigorated the interest in prizes. And there have been prizes that NASA now uses, that DARPA uses, other parts of the government. And in fact, we recently launched a platform called HeroX, a spin-out of X Prize. And this is a platform where anyone, a company, a CEO, an entrepreneur, a community, can actually have the community help them design a prize, develop a prize, fund a prize, and launch a prize. And because the XPRIZE Foundation, we only launch two or three prizes a year, and these are typically $5, $10 million prizes, HeroX becomes a platform we could launch a $50,000 prize.
We're talking about space innovation, yet your interest also lies in the self. You have interest in human longevity. You've had a project with Craig Venter, who decoded the human genome. And it's interesting because when we talk about space, it's an area that we all can talk about comfortably, whereas the self and wanting to stay younger is kind of highly personal. When you look in the mirror, you're like, I thought I was impervious to growing old, but it's happened,
yeah.
You know? And those are such deeply personal reactions. And it's just striking how, on the face of it, two very diametrically opposed things happen to have a lot of commonality in the people who push the innovations forward in those fields. Like Martine Rothblatt, for example, she's an innovator focused on space and satellites, yet she's also focused on life extension and the self. And I'm wondering, is there a coincidence in that parallel?
Sure. And I know Martine for 30 years. She's a dear friend and a brilliant, brilliant human. There is the following commonality. As entrepreneurs become more and more enabled to do bigger and bolder things, and this is the premise of my book, Bold, there are tools that allow us to do things that only the largest governments and corporations could do before. And we, as individuals, are far more risk takers than anybody else. And when you think about what has driven humanity forever, and what the epic journeys of the early European settlers talked about, you know, what were the Europeans coming to the New World looking for? Gold and for the Fountain of Youth. The space exploration element is our continuation of our epic journey. It is the journey looking for new lands, for new resources. My company, Planetary Resources, is a company backed by a group of amazing investors building spacecraft to go out to near-Earth asteroids to look for fuels and precious materials. The company we recently announced, Human Longevity, with Craig Venter and Bob Hariri, is a company that is focused on extending the healthy human lifespan. How do you add 10, 20, 30, you know, a target of 40 years on a human lifespan? People who want to think bigger and bigger, this is where you target.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Pierre Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZE, a foundation that drives innovation through competition with the hopes of improving the human experience. These prizes are focused on bold yet achievable projects ranging from space exploration to the human genome. Pierre is author with Stephen Kotler of Abundance, Future is Better Than You Think, about technology innovation driving better standards of living for the world's growing population, and Bold, the importance of technology disruption. I want to talk about some other prizes in addition to the first, one of which is the Archon Genomics Prize,
yeah.
Which was finding the first team to rapidly sequence 100 whole human genomes using centenarians. Mm-hmm. Why was that stopped, by the way?
So we launched that prize, and then we made a choice to shut it down. It's the first prize we ever shut down. And we made the choice because it turned out that, you know, we want to use prizes as a means to incentivize breakthroughs and innovation. Very rapidly after we announced it, that market started moving completely independent of the prize. The rate of genome sequencing price performance was going five times faster than Moore's Law. And it just seemed like that was not likely to be a prize that was going to change the system.
It was not audacious enough, or
It was audacious enough when it was first proposed, but it turned out not to be needed. Our goal is to use prizes to incentivize new investments, new behaviors, new risk-taking to drive things that are stuck. And it turned out that was not a field that was stuck.
Another example of a prize is the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize, which is creating non-invasive health diagnostic devices, basically detecting mono and HIV and osteoporosis. Are they basically just packs that you have that you could bring into the developing world? Or
no, so the goal here is, and again, going back to childhood experiences and vision of Star Trek, I was having lunch with Paul Jacobs, who's now the chairman of Qualcomm. We were talking about X Prizes, and I said, one of the X Prizes I'd love to do is to bring the Star Trek tricorder to life. That device that, you know, that Bones, that Dr. McCoy or Spock used to use to diagnose somebody. You'd wave it over them and say, Jim, he's an alien, you know, and he'd be able to tell what's going on. And Paul said, I love it. I would love to do that. And so very rapidly, we defined what that is, and Qualcomm put up $20 million, 10 for its purse, 10 for the operations. And this was is an XPRIZE that asked teams to build a handheld mobile device. And it's not for a doctor or for a nurse. It's from a mom and dad at 2 o'clock in the morning when your kid is sick and you want to know what's going on. And it's a device that is about self-diagnostics. And this is about a user interface that allows you to become the CEO of your own health.
You are the enabler for these innovations in a way. I don't want to call you the Tom Sawyer getting others to do work for you. Have you been called that before?
No, not yet. don't tell anybody.
What do you enjoy building yourself?
I enjoy building companies and organizations. I mean, the last two that I have been working on is Human Longevity, where I'm the co-founder and vice chairman, and we're building out the world's largest genome sequencing facility on the planet. And our goal is to add 30 to 40 healthy years in a person's lifespan. That's a big deal. The other company, which I spend a lot of time on and I'm passionate about, is Planetary Resources. You know, everything we hold of value on Earth, metals, minerals, energy, real estate, is a crumb in a supermarket filled with resources. And so our job is we're building the spacecraft that can go out to prospect, to image, to claim, to effectively eventually gain ownership of these resources that then allow us to uplift all of humanity, because we should not be a resource-limited species.
Does all this work in the kind of extraterrestrial or space make you sometimes just feel uber tiny, like such that, you know what, like ultimately I'm going to die and it's all okay?
You know what I mean? The comment of I'm going to die and it's all okay has not crossed my mind recently. I prefer to extend human life than succumb to it. You know, I still have hopes for my generation to be one of the first generations that has the option to live long enough to live forever.
You're older than I, but we're kind of the same generation. We might be that Moses who is looking at the promised land, but not actually ever arriving.
I'm working really hard to arrive there, and I will not give up. The other side of space flight is a different realization. I look at it differently, which is I think millions of years from now, hundreds of thousands of years from now, when we look back in time, whatever we've evolved to, it'll be these next few decades that the human race has moved off the planet irreversibly. And we're at that cusp. You know, last time this happened is when the lungfish moved out of the oceans onto the land. And it's a very magical time to be alive. We really are during a period of massive transformation of what it is to be human. And we're going to be defining that.
Don't you think every generation feels that they're on the cusp of just great explosive innovation?
Probably. I think that the realization is the rate of innovation continues to increase. And so there is, as my friend Ray Kurzweil calls, a singularity at which the point of change is so fast, it's not predictable. You know, this is where AI and 3D printing and robotics and all of these things are transforming our world at such a rate that you can't really predict what you're going to have next month, let alone next year. We're in a process of merging with technology. And people don't realize that, right? You outsource your memory for telephone numbers to Outlook. You outsource your spelling to Microsoft Word. And we're beginning to incorporate technology into our bodies. We communicate across the globe by using technology. We fly at you know, near supersonic speeds using technology. And I think we're going to start to begin to plug technology in as we investigate virtual worlds and AI and human-machine interfaces. You know, it's not 50 years from now. I'm talking about this decade.
We talk about AI, artificial intelligence, and 3D printing and virtual worlds. And you're not of this camp, but others are of the camp where they just say, don't want it. Like, I don't need a virtual world in which, you know, I'm going to beam a robot to put me into the Philippines for 5 minutes and come back out. And for instance, when I was a little girl, I remember when roll-up windows in my car turned into, like, button windows. And of course, I thought it was the coolest thing. But why doesn't a roll-up window work? You know what I'm talking about?
So the challenge is people who romanticize the past and who say, I don't need that, go and take away their email, their cell phone, their use of a car, an airplane, and they'll scream. Very few of our listeners here actually grow their own food, milk their own cows, you know, go slaughter their own pigs, which is what two-thirds of Americans did 150 years ago. But it's through technology that we increase the standards of living. That, you know, what's made us better as a species over the last 100 years isn't smarter politicians. We haven't gotten smarter. It's been the impact of technology. My friend Steven Pinker at Harvard wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, in which he shows us we're living during the most peaceful time ever in human history. In my second issue of Abundance, I have all these 80 charts in the back, and there's actually one chart which shows the more technologically enabled a society is, the happier it is.
You're the co-author with Stephen Kotler of two books, most recently of Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. Can you describe it?
So Abundance was a book that, you know, topped the New York Times list for 9 weeks, and it's a book of where the world is going to be in 20 or 30 years. But I wanted to write a book for entrepreneurs of how you get us there. And Bold is a how-to manual. It's sort of a roadmap. Built into three sections. The first is the notion that entrepreneurs today have access to extraordinary technology. It's how you can use 3D printing, AI, infinite computing, synthetic biology, these tools that enable you as an individual, I don't care if you're in high school, or college, if you've never done techie things before, these are tools that each of us have. And I give examples of people with no background using these tools to go and build companies. The second part of the book is about bold thinking, and I interview and do extensive research on Elon Musk and Larry Page and Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson and how you think at scale. And it's the realization that the majority of the world is linear, and they think 10% bigger. A great year is when your revenue or your products or services or your business grows 10%. And the whole notion is that is so last decade. That today you need to be able to think 10 times bigger, not 10% bigger. The third part of the book is these bold tools. Crowdfunding is enabling $15 billion of capital this year. Crowdsourcing, the notion that in this hyper-connected world, there are billions of people you can connect with. If you want information on quantum physics or genome sequencing, there are experts out there you can buy by the hour to help you in your business.
Even companies like Google, without perhaps making it explicit, do a form of crowdsourcing when they put out betas and they have the public tweak and perfect whatever innovation is happening, which is very different from, let's say, Apple, which is very like the hen has laid its egg and
yes,
here it is.
Exactly. Very open source versus closed.
Do you see any parallels with a natural world where crowdsourcing?
Listen, we live in a world of Darwinism where we are constantly taking experiments. Nature is taking trillions of experiments per year. Every time a small genetic mutation occurs, it's an experiment. We are, as humans, the peak of that evolutionary branch, at least for intelligence. And it's the natural way of doing things.
What might I not know about you?
Well, I mean, I'm a father of 3.5-year-old twin boys. I have a pilot's license. I am traveling way too much all the time.
What has surprised you about fatherhood? That
how much I care about it, how much I enjoy it, and the challenge of and the myth of living a balanced life. And it's also how much it's nature versus nurture. I know my children's personality from like the day they were born to today. The fundamental cornerstones haven't changed, and so it's all coded in the genome. My friend Craig Venter, who's my co-founder in Human Longevity, talks about how much we underappreciate how much your genome codes for how you look, the sound of your voice, the structures of your brain, your memory, your skills, your personality, all of these things. So we're going to start to unlock in ways that we haven't even considered yet from your sequence who you are in society.
Are you married?
I am.
Do you meditate?
Not yet, but man, do I need it.
On the non-technology front,
yeah.
Aside from being like with your children,
yes.
What do you enjoy?
I love flying. I mean, actually, the closest I come to meditating is when I'm, you know, flying an airplane, and I'm focused on one thing. Until the autopilot goes on, then I focus on my email.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
My guest has been Peter Diamandis. Coming up, we'll meet Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, a cybersecurity company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.